All right, we are back. The rhetoric training for America, rhetoric warriors slash political persuasion training for America podcast. It's triple named at this point. We'll get it locked down soon. I'm Dr. Dan. You know, it's a rhetorical rodeo right now. Like, and all the animals have broken out of the cages and they're in the stands. And nobody knows what to do, and it's just gone nuts in the political persuasion world, especially. So the more we can do, I guess, to rope these doggies and submit them, the better. David Payne is back today. We're going to talk, I think, about class and political rhetoric right now, because Trump has crisscrossed some class boundaries and themes. He crisscrosses everything, so that's his thing. The weave, right, is really just a conflation of things that don't belong in one place, settling now in a new place. But suppose we're going to talk about class and rhetoric today. So, Dave Payne, back in the game.
Hi there. Well, yeah, I don't know. That's a general wow, a big area to stake a claim in, right?
Barbie's thing. You're like, Trump said, hey, you can get by with only two Barbies. And you're like, hey, we need to, that's class right there.
Well, that's true. That's true. And what I'm feeling, though, that was like almost 10 days ago, maybe, you know, we didn't get scheduled in time. So we've already moved on to these other grotesquities. They just accepted the Qatar airplane.
Yep.
That's done. So that kind of moved the Barbie thing to the side, and now we're on the big bad beautiful bill, which is still about class, I'm sure. But once again, I'm sort of feeling a victim of what we identified some time ago as the fire hose approach to, if it's just shooting at you all the time, you can't find any orientation. Now I think it's, you know, we're just all floating in some sort of, giant flood.
Well, and as we were saying
waiting for a little boat to come by, I guess. I don't know.
Right. And as we were saying before we started, it's multiple fire hoses. It's not one. You can't identify, and new ones are popping up all the time. The, you know, that sort of promoter mentality that Trump has of use whatever is there, you know, that P.T. Barnum, it doesn't matter what pops up as long as it gets attention. If it's a 9,000-foot elephant or a 16-inch person, I don't care. I'm going to use it. I'm going to shove it in the public's face, and it's going to get attention. And just using that promoter's, you know, what I would call promoter consciousness, promoter structure for his rhetoric, it's just so, you know, disruptive in the political space.
Yeah, and I think we've moved to a kind of a meta place with a lot of this, and we can go back to class and Barbies to see if we can pull a thread through. But once again, with caution that if we're the ones doing sense making out of this, we're doing their job for them, and our criticism is always playing catch up, and that may be part of the game here, right? And furthermore, what we've observed many times is kind of just the whether done intuitively or through media genius, I no longer can even speculate. The idea of just wait out the news cycle and something else. So let's just make it bigger and worse, whatever it is, and the other thing will be displaced. So
continue to light fires. They can't.
And so we're at this place of what is the motive? And I think that's kind of where the conversation is at the moment, that everybody's kind of staggering going, and you just did one version of it, right? Okay, of just keep lighting the fires or whatever, or you know, keep it going. And that is an interesting moment, I think, because we went from this kind of psychological diagnosis to, I think it was Robert Reich this morning's column. Why do they want to destroy America? What is going on? So at any rate, I think that sort of new level or more intense focus on what is this? You know, it's all about Trump, and that may be the bottom line.
Well, but think about it. Like, go back to the movie Wall Street, right? So Michael Douglas back in the 80s, you know, had the phenomenon of all these investment bankers buying up existing corporations that had been there forever and had cultural value and, you know, social value, and selling them off for parts. And that business structure fits very well into what's happening with America. Like, he's just going in, you know, by institution, and breaking it up and selling it off for parts. Like what he did with the, you know, USAID. Like, oh, we're sending all this money out into the world. Let's take that over. And part of that was like, they said he wanted it because it has a $500 million building that he liked. And so he just shoved the USAID out of the government and took the building. And he hadn't put his face on it, I think, today. Like, he had a huge mural put up. So it does fit within that business structure. It's not a political structure.
And when the movie investigates Gordon Gekko's motivation on the matter of why does he betray his friend and sell Blue Star off the airlines, he says, because it could be done. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what you're saying. It's just there to be done.
Yeah.
And there's power in that. And that same motive was ascribed in Pretty Woman that he's redeemed from that somehow. But that's what he's up to, is just doing it. And it is tied back to some sort of, you know, father figure, a terrible childhood kind of orientation. And that all fits too. It's just, to me, kind of stepping back from, you know, and they're asking this now about the airplane. Why does one even bother? Right. It makes no real sense except to see if you can get by with it. Right. Nobody, it just, once again, the corruption, our Supreme Court justice sort of incidentally named it and said, this sounds like a catch me if you can thing. If you think about the motivation in that movie, the imposter of, I can just get by with it. And there's kind of this desire to keep pushing it until somebody stops you.
He said this many times during the debate with Hillary Clinton when she was calling him out on not paying his taxes, you know, using the depreciation clause to write off everything, you know, as a loss so that he didn't have to, you know, pay taxes. And he's like, it's not my fault that I can do that. Like, your tax code isn't strong enough to stop me. Therefore, it's your fault, you know, and that's that kind of predator mentality that says if, you know, if the prey doesn't protect itself well enough, then it's prey's fault that I caught it. Yeah.
Well, but once again, so the whole let them eat cake moment was displaced with the giant airplane, bribe. I think one commenter today was, why bother? Because with the bribes that the crypto people are giving him, he buys his own jumbo jet.
Yeah.
So once again, it's back to it's there to be done, and I can get by with it, I guess. Anyway, not to derail, except I think we can thread back through these things to kind of the Marie Antoinette moment of just a sense of immunity and impunity, right?
Well, it's like, let me eat cake. Like, they can't stop me from eating the cake, you know. Right. Like, you don't have, I'm eating your cake, and you can't.
And that's kind of a slightly more nuanced read of Marie Antoinette, I think. That's what I would do, is just eat cake. So,
who are
these people that are upset? At any rate, when that moment happened originally, it seemed to me that the media were investigating, back to tie this together, if I can. They were investigating Trump's motivation for saying that. What's his view of things that he would say something like that? You could only have two Barbies. And I think the NBC interviewer at the time says, are you saying that that there's not going to be enough Barbies on the shelves? Which I think completely missed the point. And he said, no, that's what I'm saying. Nobody even looked at it. What was upsetting me at the time, or echoing for me, is nobody even looked at it from the class angle, that there are people for whom, you know, if you just look at the middle class people or the upper middle class people, some of the kids have 20 Barbies. And maybe that's not the most important thing in the world. But there are, right, probably 40% of the people out there who might have to actually go without something to buy one Barbie. And those people are not even populating this entire domain of concern from either Trump or the media that's interrogating him about his pose. So we're not really, I mean, the poverty class is completely eliminated from any conversation. And that's just, you know, with the big bad budget bill today, that's even more true. We will cut Medicare across the board, $500 million, while giving a tax cut for the very wealthy.
But they'll give it back.
What's that?
They'll give it back in the form of jobs and, you know, charity. And that's what the rich do. When you give them more money, they distribute it fairly amongst the people.
Right. Yeah, you know, that might have been true in 1953, that the investment class needed more money. Of course, they were paying 90% taxes then. So then the claim that, oh, we need more money so we can invest in companies that give jobs. But, the investment class, which now takes up 50 to 55% of the population, that's not true of the money we're overvaluing the stock market.
Right.
With, or making homes unaffordable with. That's just a glut of investment capital that has no impact whatsoever on whether, you know, companies produce jobs or not. So, that's one of those things that needs to go by the wayside.
Yeah.
I don't think people even bother to argue that anymore.
Well, but they are still using it, and they are still using, like, the waste and fraud and abuse of Reagan rhetoric. You know, literally just the exact same terminology as everything but welfare mother. You know, every single trope coming back up to go, you know, and you talk about, like, the weird thing for me with Trump and talking about the Barbies was that was him just amalgamizing, and, you know, he'll grab any from any rhetorical pool, whatever, austerity rhetoric. You know, like, how could he possibly get that out of his mouth? You know, some type of austerity, you know, rhetorical.
Some sort of recognition that there are poor people in the world.
Like, that there's limits. Like, you people may have to have some, you know, limits, while for the rest of us, sorry, I have none. But, like, he'll poach anywhere. It doesn't matter. You know, but he poached that for a few minutes. And it was, like, to hear that come out of his mouth was so weird to me. You know, but, and when you called it as, like, you know, oh, he's touching on class, which he does every once in a while. You know, he has this sense somehow of, I guess because he was in money for so long in construction, you know, in New York, that he does have an awareness of the working class. You know, he does have an awareness that they exist. And every once in a while, he'll pop, something will pop into his rhetoric about it.
What one wonders, I mean, if you get to the whole, he must, because he has to be told, I think, on occasion that, in fact, that's his constituency.
Yeah.
Well, about the whole tariffs, they had to have a meeting and somebody explained that this would actually impact the people that are voting for him.
When he pulled out the word groceries into his lexicon, and he was so proud of himself. He's like, I don't think anybody uses that term ever. Like, that's a term I invented, and I'm using it in politics. It's like, wow.
Well, it's like the Dr. Oz moment. You recall that he was identifying with the people having trouble with groceries by talking what he needed for a crudité, right?
Yeah, that's what you want to throw a French word at people. That's great.
And Fetterman made fun of that until he you know. But and of course now Dr. Oz is in charge of Medicare or something like that. Anyway. But one wonders as he's talking about the manufacturing jobs that he's bringing back, what his depth of understanding is, because who is going to work in those jobs, and what are the consequences? What does that mean? If we're going to compete with China or India or South Vietnam or whatever on the basis of manufacturing jobs, that means we need an underclass that is poorly paid and willing to work, that has no other resource except, and certainly none of our children have been raised to do that, right?
No.
One wonders. I was at Home Depot today with a similar echo of the woman checking me out, because there was a long lines at the self-checkout for strangers. And then, so I went there, I said, I think Home Depot needs to hire some more people. She says, well, you know, these young people won't stay. And this is something I hear over and over and over again. They won't take these jobs.
Yeah.
And here I am, 65, she's probably at least that, doing the job for probably minimum wage and no place else to go. But
well, like we were saying, like my first job, because he broke into the gaming industry at 17, was $100K plus. And so now he quit that job and he's got no sense of what other jobs pay. Like he said, he goes, I was thinking about just getting a job like at Trader Joe's, you know, just to kind of have something to do and hang, you know. He goes, like, even if they paid me like $25 an hour, I can't live on that. I'm like, we're not going to pay you $25 an hour, bro.
That's funny. Yeah, no concept really of,
Well, and I'm curious, we both come from working class backgrounds. Right. And to me, like, for a long time, there was such a huge bulldozer of political power in America. Like, the fact that you, like, and Biden used this forever. You know, I come from the working class, I'm the poorest member of Congress, you know, all that kind of stuff. Is that poachable? Like, has the GOP really managed to grab that turf, even though that they're the crazy, you know, people who are taking away all the foundations and support systems to the working class? I mean, is that is that the Southern strategy come to fruition?
To just take away the undersupports of the working class?
Well, just take away, I mean, just to adopt the rhetoric or somehow to sever the working class from the Democrats. You know, that they don't believe the Democratic rhetoric anymore. They see the Democrats as elitists.
Sure. Well, if you look at it from the criticism of what the Democrats have done, I think that's absolutely a reasonable critique. How did they lose, right, labor, basically, as a political entity? And it may well be the backside of the Southern strategy, right, mm-hmm. which is race and the competition among the working class about race, which is, you know, where racism is most keen, is in competition for work.
Right.
Plain and simple, always has been. You know, we could be looking at, but yes, there's a, you know, that's a complicated question. There's so more than one front. The 50-year campaign to make liberalism or socialism a dirty word, which, you know, taints labor, or that approach to labor, the organized labor. Of course, in the previous election, at least there was some gain of that back in Democratic support. But that's part of it, seems to me. So who is the working class, I think, is a profound obscurantism, right? That is to so obscure what that who they identify with. And if you approach it from the other direction of why are these people voting for Trump, that seems obvious. Why are you voting for Trump? Right? What is it that this is going to do for you? How does what's happening right now give you cheaper eggs? How does, you know, what does any of this do for you? And to completely hide in ideology what it's doing to hurt you. So I'd say that is, you know, a giant Gordian knot of economic class-based rhetoric. So part of it is the expansion of the middle class to be a signifier so empty of any factual meaning, that everybody from $15,000 a year to $400,000 a year can consider themselves middle class, culturally, ideologically. So where does the poverty class exist in any of that? So if you look at, you know, critics like Thomas Frank, I think has really been nailing that on part of what's happened with the Democrats, how they lost labor. Reverend Barber has been looking at just how, if the Democrats could in any way, shape, or form even get part of the poor, the real poor, to vote for them, they would win every election. Why aren't they? Why is in the rhetoric of neither party, the rhetoric of neither party even recognizes the existence of the poor in any meaningful, concrete way. So it gets some sort of lip service, I think, from, you know. But when they say the poor, they really mean the lower middle class, the struggle of the working class, those people with jobs. And that's not really populated by the really struggling poor. As any, it's just not a meaningful political category.
Do you think it got, again, sort of, look at the severances between the promissory rhetoric of what I'm going to do for the working class, manufacturing and all that, again, which Biden hit very, very hard all the time, severed from results, because Biden got results, like he did. He got like manufacturing results. He got a lot of, you know, ostensibly demonstrable factual results from that approach.
Wages increased in real terms for the first time in 30 years, yeah.
But it was severed from the rhetoric. Like, people didn't assign that to him. Like, is that because of the confusing nature of what's happened in this, you know, maelstrom of rhetoric now? People can't see through it to make
Well, economics are pretty complicated. Where does inflation come from? Why did we have inflation? That whole conversation went, you know, Democrats took the hit for that. And so many people, I think, used as a mask of their antipathy toward the Democratic nominee. Groceries are too high, I'm voting for Trump. I think that hit a lot of other reasons why. But it did not engage an understanding that post-pandemic we were going to have inflation, period. And every other country in the world had worse inflation than us, period. So that, they just couldn't sell that message as a, you know, once again, economics right now are extremely complicated, and most people don't have a clue how these things happen.
So it's too much logos for American people to handle.
Too much logos, right? There's your T-shirt from Rhetoric Warrior.
Logos, yeah. The amount of logos is killing us. Which in some ways, it's something I've worked on quite a bit with people about. Like in marketing, businesses constantly, when they put together their own marketing and executives put together marketing, they want to load it up with logos, you know, with proof points and claims and numbers. And I'm like, nobody's reading any of that, dude. Like, you know, throw a gecko on there and just repeat it over and over again, saying, save 15% in 15 minutes. They can handle the number 15. That's as deep as you want to go, because, I mean, any type of logos processing, it just takes so much now, you know. And even like this, like tariffs, suddenly tariffs grow up as a word. That word didn't exist, you know, for most of American history. Like, it's this right. Tangential word way back over here from Hoot Smalley back in like, what, the 20s? And suddenly Trump just resurrected it. And people acting like they understand, you know, what that means. It's fascinating to watch, but it's a little piece of logos that loses all of its actual logos, you know, and becomes this bludgeon.
Well, and once again, back to kind of the bigger, the fire hose. We spend so much time struggling over the semantic of tariffs. What are they and who pays for them? And like the report yesterday, Trump finally admits that Americans pay the tariffs. And this is like a rhetorical victory after 4 months of near economic disaster and, you know, whatever, back and forth, yada, yada, yada. As though that's, you know, and probably 80% of the people didn't see this report at all, or that Trump confessed this, and he'll probably change his mind next time it comes up. So, but you're, just the point is, we spent all that much time struggling over the meaning of tariff as a meaningful thing when the real game was being played. People buying and selling on the market fluctuations that were going on, you know, the grift, the constant grift that took place around it, the power dynamics. So for the press and the academics and the message makers, you know, to try to do sense making on tariff, just to take your example, completely was a sideshow on everything that went on. Same thing with this airplane. We spent so much time, is this a bribe? Is this constitutional? Is this right? Who has to approve this? By the way, our attorney general signed off on it. Really? I mean, they could do that on behalf of the Air Force? Is that legitimate. So we're going to spend days process, and only the people watching MSNBC are going to spend those days, mind you, right? Only the 10% obsessed with this stuff are going to try to process the legalities of this whole thing. Meanwhile, what we are not talking about, the four golf courses, the Trump Towers, the real con that went in with, you know, the Biden or the Trump organization and the children. So this is one way to do the rhetorical, right, misdirection.
So if we were taking the project as a project, a rhetorical project, to recapture the working class and to get class back as a powerful rhetoric in American politics, what is Dave Payne, the consultant, how does he construct that?
You keep wanting me to solve these problems. I'm better at finding out what the. Well, once again, your invitation to that was nobody's going to read the copy, right? And Ronald Reagan figured this out, right? Now, 45 years ago, his own media director said this as much straight out. We had this controversy over labor unions. Nobody's going to read the copy. What we did on the same page, we had a picture of Ronald Reagan drinking a beer with workers. Yeah. That's what they see. So we need to go to school about messaging and the visual economy here. Logos is no longer logical processing. So once again, and we've observed this before with the media, he's like, it's lying. We're going to fact check. You know, that's you know, the ball is going to be all the way down the court by the time you get any of that done. By the time we historicize tariffs, bring in the necessary economic theory to explain it. So we're all just chasing our literary tales, whatever. Meanwhile, the news cycle has shifted to the next big, you know, event. So how does one come, you know, and we were kind of about this in our last pod. Do the Democrats just play the same game? Or is this, you know, is this the only game in town?
Right. Well,
throwing
red meat, right? That's one way of looking at this strategy of, okay, Qatar, the plane is red meat for a few days and I get everybody paying attention to me and I'm Trump. So I say, hey, it's a free gift. Why do you say no to a free gift? You know, and that's all he says, really. That's about it. You know, he just says that over and over again. So it's simple. He gets his, you know, simple logos on it and printed on it. Hey, free gift. You know, not bribe, not legal. I don't care about any of that. Like, you're gonna say no to a $400 million plane, bro? You know? And so, like, that's the piece of red meat, but it's this constant red meeting, you know? And can the Democrats do that? Like, what they're doing is just reacting to the red meat they're thrown.
Sure. How many people are going to read the New York Times investigation where we discovered that Qatar had been trying to get rid of his airplane because it was too expensive? They had already flown it to Mar-a-Lago to show it to Trump before he even went over there. And the follow-up is going to cost well over $1 billion to refurbish it to make it Air Force One. Yeah, there's no such thing as a free jumbo jet, I guess, is the
right.
The bottom line there. But anyway.
So that's still reacting.
Once again, that's all playing catch up to the event. So
you see the little performative stuff that the Democrats try to do, like Cory Booker getting up there and talking for 72 days or whatever it was. And it's so performative. It's so epideictic. It's so ceremonial. I'm like, there's nothing here, dude. Like, and like, it gets into the news cycle for a couple of days. And then yesterday, you know, he got just reamed for voting yes on one of Trump's ambassador to France nominees because he had a longtime financial connection to the guy.
Really?
You know, how are you going to hold your moral high ground when you do that?
Right.
So what is the
in the political economy, the symbolic economy of the MAGA person, that displaces 25 hours of filibuster easily.
Easily. Gone.
Yeah.
So like if we just take the red meat strategy and okay, so clearly the GOP and Trump are using the red meat strategy. Can the Democrats use that strategy?
Well, they got to use something. They got to do something with messaging, I suppose. And it seems to me they're not making the cases, but I'm the kind of person who wants those cases to be made. So that's, yeah. I think some part of it they can. I think, you know, one thing that's curious to me in the recent reporting is they'll say Trump 36% approval rating. How low is that? Well, it's not bad because the Democrats' approval rating is only 26%. And what seems to me to be wrong with this picture and this repetitive reporting is you're comparing Trump to a political party.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
The Democrat, now let's take an individual Democrat and what their approval rating is. So we're not taking, in the poll, we're making some equations there that really aren't equations at all. Now, apparently the Republicans do poll a little bit better than that, but they have a 30% pretty committed core. So they have sort of redefined what it is to be a Republican for 30% of the people, and that is to be a Trump supporter, stop, end. Yes. So there is a kind of equation to all Democrats with Trump as a displacement symbol. So I think that, you know, what we never step outside that framework of the dialectical framework of the question to ask is, what is the status of a political party? And I think the fact is that political parties by themselves have a bad approval rating, and that around 50% of people are considered themselves independent and not identifying with the party, period. So I think that's just simply a fact of our times that one would have to take into, you know. So once again, you've got to get behind a leader. And in 4 years of Biden, they did not produce another leader, so that they did nothing to restore or, you know, prepare Kamala Harris for that. They did nothing to bring anybody else forward. So they were left with Biden or nothing.
So last time we labeled the last podcast as Democrats Need a Liberal Hero, which is a strategy, right? So a really gleaming hero can maybe overcome, you know, some of these other strategies that are floating around and seem to be dominating right now, like Trump's confusion strategy, you know, the constant oscillation of topics, you know, that kind of stuff. Clearly, like if you go into mythos and you go into story, they've established Trump as a hero for 30% of the population. The Democrats have nobody that I can tell, like maybe AOC, Bernie Sanders, you know, has a little bit of heroism in it. But like Jerry
Connelly. That's not going to produce the next candidate, I predict.
Well, Jerry Connelly, you know, 86-year-old, just died yesterday, right? After having beaten AOC for the chairmanship of the most powerful committee in Congress. It's like, oh, now they're dying in Congress. That's the only way to get these guys out. So, I mean, what do you do then? Like, if we look at our tactic wheel, this is kind of how I look at rhetoric, because I sell rhetoric strategies to companies and people. It's like, okay, well, which one of these can you pull off? Like, do you have the assets to make work? And which of these, you know, would work at this point? So, the GOP has hero strategy. They have a hero, a central hero, even though it's probably only 30%. He's also a central villain, you know, to 80% of the world or whatever. But it's a strong character.
Sure. And let's go back to our theme of the day about class and kind of dissect that a little bit. Were you to come up with a hero for the class, it would not be Donald Trump. Were you to strategize that, where you'd say, here are the characteristics we want of this class hero?
I don't know, because he's such a uncontrollable, rebellious problem, that's a, you know, the anti-hero is clearly, you know, part of that.
Yeah, if you wanted to take a cynical approach and say, okay, yeah, a reality star would be good. Somebody who has the ethos of a powerful businessman and that doesn't bear up to any kind of scrutiny, that would be good. You know, but once again, it does invite the, you know, the constant just sort of taking away from him to where, you know, at least 20% of the people that voted for him really don't care for him, and they know exactly what he is. They just didn't want to vote for the other side.
Right.
So there's a lot going on there.
So as soon as Trump passes by, so for whatever way he does, like even if, you know, if he can't run again in 2028, or be, you know,
although Steve Bannon says he will be the next president at in January of 29.
So who's next? Like, do they have anybody? They don't have anybody in the hopper either that I can tell.
Well, they're asking Don Jr. if he's going to run. So
yeah, that ain't going to fly. Like, none of those. He's not going to be able to imbue the next.
You know, I'm through saying that it can't happen.
Well, that's true. I can't predict it, but I'm just saying, like, they don't have, like, Trump is very unique, had very unique assets, you know, long-term relationship with America. People knew him and all that kind of stuff. But there's nobody else in their bullpen.
Well, and I'm
less the,
you know,
Rock.
I want to hope for that this is just, you know, cult of personality, and that's one way to kind of contain that, to say that. But I think once again we would want to be smart about, and we've tried to do this in the last a few years, and there is a new book out about, by the way, J.D. Vance and his sort of classist origins, right? How he got popular to start with, the hillbillyology. And there's no doubt there will be an attempt to sort of mutate him into the next.
Yeah, for sure. He'll take that tack.
Version of this. So the seeds are possibly there. But once again, to see the class basis of the Trump rhetoric, which you have directly pointed out many times, traces back to the class rhetoric of Nixon and Reagan. The playbook is not radically different. And so the dissatisfactions of the labor class, which are terribly bound up with race, as is the identity of the Democratic Party right now. So there is that going on behind those scenes. So, but I think I would say the rhetoric doesn't just have to be about an individual. I guess was the point of saying that Trump would not necessarily be the most logical, predictable hero for this. I don't know that it is in the personal characteristics. It's what that person is selling. And Trump did a good job of selling, saying the things that, right, that class of people and their movement, going back to the Tea Party, were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And was a hero because he was a rhetorical hero, period. He would say those things.
Right.
He was like, he invented them. He just said them out loud. And so everybody thought, oh, wow, that's really cool. He's willing to say these things,
right,
and not play the game that these other people are playing.
Which is the exact definition of an actor, right? Like, just say the script, bro. How many times I've
said
to actors?
Absolutely.
I'm like, just say the script. Quit changing the script. Just say it.
So I think the Democrats need to, you know, when they sort of say, well, they need to talk in real terms. You know, I'm kind of weary with the analysis of the Democrats' problem right now. And I think, it doesn't really get to the core. What is their identity, and what is the identity of a political party? And this class identification, it is so all over the place as an ideology. I'm back with the Reverend to say, let's look at the poor people. How do you, you know?
So do we find a poor person and raise them up?
That wouldn't hurt. That wouldn't hurt. But at least, you know, what I'm saying, it doesn't have to be invested in the identity of the individual. It has to be invested in the rhetoric that they're espousing. What is their analysis? How do they convince them that they are working for these people?
Right. But again, logos is not going to work. So I remember Fetterman, you know, is a really interesting example of class.
Sure.
And,
absolutely.
You know, the way he dressed, the way he looked like a big goof. He looked like a bro. He looked like a, you know, former football player, and kind of talked a little bit of that grouchiness and seemed to have a little bit of backbone to him. I mean, apparently he's falling apart. He's at least getting character assassinated badly, for his mental illness right now. But I was always like, as soon as he appeared on the scene, the same way like Stacey Abrams, I think in some ways, as soon as she popped up, I'm like, oh, yeah, people will recognize very strong, articulate Black woman who won't back down, you know, as a poverty hero, a working class hero. They'll recognize the guy in hoodies, you know, who's showing up, you know, at black tie events in hoodies, you know, stuff like that, as a working class hero. And I'm like, either one of those people have sort of interesting capacity if they were picked up and dev'd, like really, over a couple of years or, before the election cycle starts, get them into the consciousness, it'd be an interesting play. But they don't seem to be doing any of that.
Well, you talked about AOC and you talked about Bernie, and in a way, those are two people who can actually sell what I'm talking about. I think that they are both authentically able to, from their very different generational and cultural standpoints. And if you listen to what AOC is saying in her speeches, I didn't learn this as a communist, and I didn't read Marx. I learned this because I was a waitress. There's your working class person. And look at who she's representing, and winning favor with, combined with just sort of Bernie's lifelong consistency with making this point, right? The socialist agenda, social democratic agenda, and so they both have credibility, ethos, and but neither one of them probably are going to be able to step into
Yeah.
the candidate role of a national campaign.
Right. Unfortunately, as a Hollywood casting, director, neither one of them fits the part. There's something a little odd about AOC, the way she talks,
Once again, it does not have to be the class identity of the individual. I think Josh Shapiro can make the talk. He may have other
Yeah.
detractors, but I think he can make the talk. I think Gavin Newsom can make the talk, but he also has other kinds of geopolitical baggage that might stand in the way. So I don't think I don't think it has to be the identity, because we at least rhetorically, we want the super representative, right? Ronald Reagan was not a working class,
Right. You want the Bill
person.
Clinton, the guy who comes from Arkansas and can talk, Rhodes Scholar and also talk Bubba.
Exactly. Talk Bubba, right. And he was just mercurial enough for the Times to stitch that coalition together. And I think that's probably, something that has to get done. Just the way that Trump, I think, stitches together. Kind of, I'll do anything for the business community, and right, in terms of your agenda with regulations and finance and all of that stuff. Where the rules are off, no problem. But I can win the support of these working class people as well. So I think there will be a co I think there has to be a coalition, and right now the Democrats really are not sure what that looks like.
Well, do the Democrats have to cut sort of rhetorical liabilities? And I have this little system I use with, again, when I design persuasion for companies of assets, I do an audit of assets, omissions and liabilities. So things that they got to work with, things that they're missing, like we're talking basically that the Democrats are missing class. The people that are kind of using it aren't, fully national hero worthy. I mean, I think Bernie's interesting, but he's really, really old, and he sounds so much like the old socialists, the hippies from the 70s and stuff, that it's easy to kind of turn him into, this boogeyman. But and then liabilities. So, like his age is a liability. AOC, I think, has some liabilities. I love like Jasmine Crockett, who is kind of an interesting, but very young and very new to all this, so that's a liability. What like when you look at Democrat tactics, like you said, race and gender and sexual politics and sort of all the things that have been grabbed and sort of used by the GOP to amplify the weirdo-ness of the left, do you
Right.
have to cut those loose somehow? Like, do you have to de-amplify those in order to win?
At the moment, it seems like the answer is kind of yes. I mean, you've got to de-woke somehow here. But I think if you look at the Biden coalition, it really was mainstream Democrats, centrist Democrats, anti-Trump Republicans, and he was able to capture the votes of Black America. And I think also as a class issue and a temptation to look at the Black community as monolithic in that regard didn't work.
Right.
Well,
When he lost
I mean,
it.
it worked about as good as it could have in the last election. I mean, we were talking about one of the narrow elections, and As I think almost every conversation about these things, about where we are now, should point out that the lack of participation and the low voting turnout of both Trump's wins and who they were against. And so I think there's lessons there to say, you might code that as we didn't get out the vote, but there's a reason for that. However unpleasant that those reasons might be as statements about voting America. But so I think back to your liabilities, those are very real. And, so conversation about assets, sure. But I do think that, once again, that person has to find a way to find some coalition here that will get enough people to the poll. And that shouldn't be that hard to do, given the numbers, really.
So what are they? What are the gem points, the dazzling gems that you put up in the rhetorical sky that pull people to the polls? I mean, I think, Biden, another thing that he had in his favor was people hated Trump so much, and it was not far away from COVID that Trump mismanaged so badly. So there was real suffering on the ground from Trump's ineptitude versus this kind of, more abstract suffering, like from terrorists and things like that. So there was the anti-Trumpness, which is a major gem for the.
And I think that will still be there. I think that's self-generating. So I think people will be looking for an alternative there. And I think they were looking for an alternative this time as well. So I certainly there was a profound forgetting on some people's part of how.
Well, what are the Democratic gems? I mean, just hating Trump is strong, but that's apparently not strong enough. Like, what are Democrats able to say, hey, because if it's not class, if it's not we got better jobs waiting for you, we'll bring in things, what is it other than we're nicer than the GOP? We're going to put democracy back together. Is that what's going to happen? After it's like, hey, let's
put democracy back together. Yeah. A return. Yeah, it could well be. I think the question could be meaningful of, what kind of America do you want? And is this really what you want? I'm maintaining, at least for the moment of the argument, I think some new approach to the class and not avoiding class is important. I think that's where Bernie succeeded, mm-hmm. that other Democrats failed. And that's why he got a substantial chunk. I mean, certain Bernie people insisted that their last breath that he could have beaten Trump.
Yeah.
We didn't believe it then. I'm not sure I would believe it now, but.
I don't know. Like, I think Hillary Clinton had problems with class. I think she came across
absolutely.
As and not never, worked a day in her life outside of government.
Well, and I think once I just don't think you can undercut race and gender in how we are willing to and able to cast a leader in our psychological imaginations. I just don't think that's there yet. Whatever that subtle idea of leader is, that is kind of the mythological undercurrent of all this rhetoric. I think the numbers prove that that's, enough Americans just can't get past that. And
well,
I think the data is there on it too.
I guess at least, you can think of Trump and not being working class. He is business class. So at least he's associated with some kind of American work, like that's part of the mythology that he got from his, time in Hollywood, as they made him into a mythical business leader. And at least that is in the area of work. So these other guys coming through, they're like, at least, Jimmy Carter had worked as a peanut farmer, Obama.
Well, yes, and this is a blind spot the Democrats have had all along. People are mistrustful of government, and that's been fueled on the other side. And so government, politicians, so he is the outsider. Think about how many people are elected by being the outsider and how few, right, people from the inside of government, senators, make the advance. So I think we've discussed before the kind of the monomyth of the person coming from the outside, to save the day. So I do think that is part of the identity of the hero. That is an unavoidable. That doesn't mean no one can. It means it's been very rare that they have.
And, maybe if the Democrats use the billionaire, the good billionaire. So like Mark Cuban, you know, seems to escape a lot of the scathingness indictment of the billionaires. You know, he seems to have made moral business choices, and he does publicly post a lot of anti-Trump and, you know, that kind of stuff. Something like that.
That's the governor of Illinois, right? I'm the real billionaire here, and I think that could sell. I really do.
Yeah, now that's an interesting strategy. It's still class-based to me because it's working-based, it's money-based. But it's that might be a counter strategy to, like, even a billionaire standing up there next to Trump going, yeah, that guy's not a billionaire. What a, you know, well, he is now.
The New York guy, right, Bloomberg, tried that too, right? He didn't have the other kinds of cachet that would have got him to the end of that campaign, but and mostly among the Democrats, among the conservatives, it might have actually worked pretty well to be the alternative billionaire in the conversation. So, I think the thing is that all of these elements are ultimately transformable. You know, Trump's business experience, which, you know, has to be hyphenated somehow with corruption or whatever. Which way do you want to spin it? Can be spent one way or the other way, right? And for some people, it goes one way. So that now, you know, in the middle of the tariff thing, when they, you know, talked with MAGA people about what that means to them, they said, well, we have to Trump. He's a businessman. We have to trust him here.
Right.
This is not enough for me to derail here, right? So, you know, once again, those are simply brute facts that are awaiting interpretation, or really misinterpretation. And so I think any of those things are transformable commodities. Back to your risk and asset. What are the brute facts and the degree to which they can be bent in a sympathetic direction?
Well, it'd be interesting.
And that's what identity is. Yeah.
I guess it's like, you know, the idea of you have to have some type of depth of suffering in order to get transformation. And the depth of suffering under Trump, you know, financially and that stuff hasn't been deep yet. We're not in a recession yet. We're not, you know, people are not really paying, you know, higher prices yet that they're noticing. And so when you look at it, it's like, you know, if he triggers a Great Depression and he has 2 years of people in breadlines, then yeah, he becomes the worst president, you know, in history. But it has to be real suffering. I think you said this at one point or somebody talking about it when they were talking about trying to move the Austin airport, you know, and the Austin airport was basically in an Austin neighborhood. And if there'd ever been like a major crash, you know, it would have taken you out and, you know, a ton of your neighbors. It's like, well, if that happened, they would move it, you know, but barring real tragedy, you know, real felt human suffering, when it stays as an abstraction, you're always fighting, you know, the abstractness of that potential suffering. And that's not
strong enough. People who didn't live next to the airport, it was not a meaningful salient thing. Absolutely.
Yeah. So Trump has
it could be mutated into this is a real estate deal.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and Trump hasn't caused major suffering for mainstream America, other than psychological suffering.
For voting America.
He's caused tons of psychological
suffering. If we could get 10% of the real core to vote, the election would be over.
Well,
And you do that by giving them something to vote for.
Right.
And the political footballs of stuff like health care, which is a biggie, and that is on the chopping block right now. In the current budget bill, and that could be turned into, you know, a meaningful rhetorical commodity.
Yeah, and I think Trump understands that one. Like, he keeps trying to stop them from getting rid of ACA because he's like, that one's going to hurt. You know,
well, his budget. Yeah, sure. Well, they do seem to kind of have given up on ACA at the moment, right? But Medicare, that's back to, you know, kind of the welfare queen problem. Notwithstanding, you know, what AOC properly pointed out in Congress the other day, 30 and 40% of the people in red states are on Medicare. These are white people.
Oh, right. my younger brother is on, you know, all sorts of support, and he's totally MAGA. And I'm like, bro, you know, they're coming for you. You know, your workers' comp, your disability, you know, like, you know, they're coming for you. And he's like,
you know, back to Thomas Frank's, you know, meaningful question, and what's the matter with Kansas? Why do people continue to vote against their interests? What gets put at stake there that causes them? And then there's the frog boiling problem. Oh, well, I turned up the temperature too fast on tariffs. Well, let's give it 90 days. So we'll just turn it up more slowly.
Well, and people talking about, you know, the treatment of the illegal immigrants as sort of training ground for that, you know, so we get used to people being, you know, deported in the middle of the night by guys in masks to other countries. And we start to see enemies of the state being treated that way. And it just sort of slowly, you know, sets precedent for, well, you know, these Democrats and their liberal ideas are also pretty dangerous to the state. You know, so
that narrative is out there. I mean, the instant narrative on Kamala Harris was that would be a disaster.
Well, maybe that's the next episode. We'll talk about the construction of enemies of the state, because the usefulness of villains clearly in political mythos is undeniable. I think even sort of the extracting villains from the poor class, the poverty class, as welfare.
Well, and you're right in the middle of the propaganda war, and that is going on. That and how you have to pay a lot of attention to really know which shelf the pea is under at any given time. I think that's really exactly what's going on with this deportation conversation. It's another thing of here, pay attention to this over here while we do this over here.
But that the only real end game that I can see of that is that it normalizes violent imprisonment and no habeas corpus and all these kind of things that.
Well, really, when the president decides to bring back Alcatraz because we need a big, beautiful, bad prison for our bad guys, and there's a kind of implicit assumption that the president gets to decide which prison you go to. Which only happened last week with these Venezuelan prisoners. These princes have a big jet. I need one, and these guys have bad prisons. I need one of those. It's all in the construction of power. And so I would say, you know, how does this, the semiotics of power work here? I think that's really as much as anything what's going on.
One, if again talking about taking sort of a class approach. Again, I think this is the reason why, like, I think the immigrant population, a lot of Americans don't see them as part of America. Like, this isn't being done to sort of normalize America that we understand. And so, therefore, they're not really doing this in America. It's not going to be applied to the rest of
America. Well, if you know them by racial identity, they don't assimilate into class structure. And so that's how we've managed to have a classless society, is by mapping all of that crap onto race, plain and simple. The way we typify lower classes and races, the way Europe typifies lower classes, is with the same kind of language that we typify race identity, or have done in the past. So this is, you know, when we say middle class, who are we thinking about? And the idea that there has been an ascendant black middle class is kind of a, it's just not on the game board, really. And if so, do we really want that? Or do we really want, you know, the rise of the Hispanic population here and the assimilation into our class structure? And no, I think that's what this othering is all about, right? And so if as long as you're dealing with the abstractions of working class, labor, I don't think for at least white America, and this is a characteristic red state phenomenon, I guess, that's largely a white thing, when in reality it's not at all.
Right. Well, again, that's logos versus mythos, right? Like, in reality, as soon as people say in reality, I'm like, oh, now you're into facts. People aren't going to follow that.
Which reality is that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, if we look at democratics, of who has jobs, who's working in them, and what the working class is about. But once again, African-Americans, or some of them, have had the similar difficulty with seeing themselves as their interests also invested in these class arguments, right? This is writ large here, this is also, right, sort of the ramifications of two or three decades of identity politics. And one consistent analysis of Trumpism and Vanceism is that this is white people identity politics played.
Yeah, it's hard to argue.
Behind the racial signifiers in here, period.
It's hard to argue against that as the master rhetorical strategy here. Yeah. You know. Well, once again, like, trying to... Trying to calm the conflation hurricane, you know, of modern rhetoric as it bounces around in these kind of odd ways in politics is you're chasing ping pong balls in a hurricane.
Well, and that's part of the deal, is that most people are trying to protect themselves from it by being apolitical. I'm not going to identify with the political party. I'm not going to watch the news. I'm not going to read the, you know, because it's upsetting. It's counterproductive. It's frustrating. But this doesn't bring us to the big bad parade on Trump's birthday and what America, how America might respond to that. So there is organization going on. I think it might be interesting.
Yeah,
a giant symbol.
Right. I mean, how do you avoid, you know, looking communist at that point? Hopefully he'll stand there and look like, you know, Mao, you know, looking over the troops, you know, because it's just so on the nose, you know, as a story structure. We'll see how that one plays. Well, cool, man. Once again, always stuff to talk about. We'll come back after the big, big, beautiful parade. I just love that as a rhetorical location, the dear leader, you know, like him trying to don all of that, but not get associated with, I guess we're fairly far away from true communist, you know, sort of narratives being so strong in America of like the Chinese and the Russian and even the Korean, but it's going to bubble back up.
The collapse of the military with the executive is an interesting, and this is part of what the big bad airplane and the big bad budget are all about too.
So, all right, well, we'll swing back around. Appreciate it. Thanks for jumping back in to another episode of Rhetoric Training for America. Get out there, persuade people. Can't leave it to the professionals, because they'll do all sorts of crazy things to you. Hold on.